time to see where curiosity will take us.
Very early this morning, a state-of-the-art space laboratory called Curiosity arrived on Mars's Gale Crater, one of the lowest points on the Red Planet, in one of the most complicated space landings ever done by NASA. It was about 7 minutes in between the time that Curiosity reached the Martian atmosphere to the time it landed on Gale Crater, and that time in between consisted of maneuvers involving heat shields, a supersonic parachute, and a sky crane. And because it takes about 14 minutes for a signal to go to Mars and come back to Earth, all of this was done blind. Now that it has landed, Curiosity, about twice of the size of the two prior Mars rovers, takes on the task of searching for what scientists call the ingredients for life on the Red Planet, most noticeably water, carbon, and energy, to see if life exists or ever existed there. But Curiosity isn't the only curious event going on in space. The Juno mission soon reaches Jupiter to learn more about our solar system's largest planet. Also, the Dawn mission completes its extensive look at the asteroid Vesta before it heads to a new asteroid on the other side of the asteroid belt. Also this month, we'll have an asteroid show, solar showers, and a rare blue moon. And so today in The Exchange, our Sky Guys join us to talk about all things astronomical, and we want to hear from you. Did you stay up until the wee hours of this morning to watch Curiosity land? Are you following other NASA missions? Give us a call, the Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us a short email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org, or post a comment on our Facebook page. And our Sky Guys are John Gianforte, co-founder of the Astronomical Society of Northern New England, an astronomy lecturer at UNH and Granite State College. His website is theskyguy.org. And John, it's really nice to see you. I know you're tired. I know you were up late last night. Thanks for being here.
Great to be here, Laura.
Also with us, Mal Cameron, longtime educator at the McAuliffe-Shepard Discovery Center. And Mal, nice to see you too, and good morning.
Great to be here.
Well, and I know both of you are tired, but in a very good mood because that Curiosity rover landed successfully after what was called by everybody 7 minutes of terror. John, you stayed up to watch it. What did you think? What was it like?
It was amazing. Short of being there at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, watching it on NASA television, watching the reaction of the staff at JPL, listening to the milestones reached by the spacecraft, 100 meters, horizontal velocity almost zero, just touched down very gently. When they said the sky crane was operating, you could just imagine from watching the animation video that they put out a few months ago. You could just see what was happening. And when they said touchdown confirmed, it was it. And 9 minutes later, we had a thumbnail image on Mars. It was just amazing.
You know, Mal, there was a lot of circulation and talk about this 7 minutes of terror where they had to land this thing. And right. From what I understand, the problem was, or the challenge was, and clearly they overcame that challenge, this thing is a lot bigger than the earlier rovers. This is the size of a car. So earlier rovers were sort of put in big airbags and just bounced on the surface of Mars. Mm-hmm. You couldn't do that with this.
It weighs about 15 times more than the rovers that are there now. Those rovers were with airbags, and they bounced around fine, but you couldn't do it with this, so they had to come up with a totally different method, and they came up with this sky crane idea that I'm sure most listeners are probably already familiar with it because it's been broadcast so much. I have to tell you personally, I remember a couple of years ago or so where we got, when at the Discovery Center, we got a video that we found and say, here's the way the next rover is going to land on Mars. And we all looked at it and said, what? They're out of their mind. So talk about an engineering nightmare and an engineering challenge. It was just incredible. And by golly, they did it. That's the way they did it. And every step along the way was reasonable. They needed a supersonic parachute to slow it down. From 13,000 miles an hour, brings it down to a mere 1,000 miles an hour. And then they have the jetpacks come out, slowing it down to a couple of hundred miles an hour. And then it gets down to zero, all in 7 minutes, and just gently puts it on the surface. And the top of it gets severed off and flies away into the distance so it wouldn't hurt the rover and land on top of it. All these things they had to reason out. And yet, give this pinpoint landing. I mean, you can find Mars in the night sky right now. Well, not this moment, but tonight you could find it in the night sky, in the southwestern sky, and you look at that little dot in the sky and realize that some people with a lot of smarts and a lot of math and a lot of science and physics, they can get a probe to go not only to that little dot, but land it on a very specific spot with a landing area that is no larger than Rhode Island and Connecticut combined.
What you have to keep in mind is not only are both planets moving around the sun in their orbits. Earth and Mars. I mean, Earth is traveling around the sun at about just under 19 miles per second in its elliptical orbit. Mars traveling around the sun a little bit slower because it's further away. But both planets are rotating as well. So they're revolving on their axis and they're revolving around the sun. So you have to add those factors in as well. So that makes it even more amazing. And what I didn't really realize until watching NASA television during the pre-landing show was that Earth was setting viewed from Mars where the rover was supposed to land. And if it hadn't been for two spacecraft that were crisscrossing, let's say, in view of the spacecraft during its descent and landing, we wouldn't have found out for quite a long time if we had been successful, if it survived the landing. And when you showed those simulations, one planet coming from the north headed south, one planet coming up from the south headed north, they crossed in sight of the landing site. If it hadn't been for that, it would have been a long night.
You know, Mal, you raise a great point. First of all, it's amazing to think that you can land in this specific spot on this planet that is really a pinpoint of light from here. But that's a great point, while both planets are moving. So it is triply amazing.
Well, the relationship is to football. You get, Tom Brady out there trying to hit his receiver who's moving across the field. And when he throws that football, he has to throw it where he perceives that receiver is going to be and not where he sees him at the time he throws the ball. Same way with Mars. You have to calculate where Mars is going to be, and so the spacecraft and the planet can get together at the same spot in space. Can't aim it at where you see it at the day of launch because it won't be there by the time the spacecraft gets there.
So you have to calculate where it's going to be over that period of time that it gets there.
Absolutely.
Let me invite our listeners to join us, and then I have a lot more questions just about this mission and the other missions that are going on. Our number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. And as you no doubt heard, NASA successfully landed its largest space laboratory ever on Mars. It was a big deal early in the morning. We're looking at how they did it, and in just a minute, we'll look at what they hope to learn from the rover Curiosity. Our number for you to join us with your questions or comments is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email is exchange@nhpr.org, or you can post a comment on our Facebook page. Our sky guys are Mal Cameron with the McAuliffe Shepherd Discovery Center and John Gianforte, co-founder of the Astronomical Society of Northern New England. A couple more questions for you gentlemen on this. Now that we've talked about how cool it is that it landed and really how amazing it is that it landed. So, John, how are they going to give Curiosity instructions about what to do next?
Well, everything is done by radio communication. We can use the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter and the Mars Odyssey spacecraft, both NASA spacecraft, to relay commands to the spacecraft and also to acquire data from the spacecraft. The rover can also communicate directly with Earth when it's in view of the spacecraft. It's kind of like line-of-sight communication between the rover on the ground on Mars and Earth. As long as that's possible, as long as you can see Earth in the sky, you can communicate directly. But if not, you can still use the other spacecraft as relay stations, if you will.
And what are these other spacecraft again?
Mars Odyssey,
mm-hmm,
and the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter.
So these are spacecraft that are orbiting Mars, helping Curiosity send information back?
They can, yes. And that is what was on tap last night. Mars Odyssey actually did relay information. The first images were sent back from Curiosity to Mars Odyssey and then to Earth.
Mal, real quick from you.
Yeah. In fact, it was, I believe, the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter that, well, both of them were actually mapping Mars, and it was those orbiters that helped them choose this particular landing spot.
I want to take some calls, gentlemen, and then a couple more questions about this mission. The number, 1-800-892-6477. Dave is up first from Concord. Hi, Dave. You're on the air. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. How are you doing?
Good.
I was just curious what sort of differences in the experiments are going to be performed this time compared to the previous expeditions. Sort of, you know, why such a large rover? Is it just because of a different instruments that are needed compared to previous ones, and you know, how it's going to be different than previous expeditions?
Excellent question, Dave. And it'll take us a couple minutes to answer this one, gentlemen. But let's just start off, Mal. I mean, how is this different from the earlier rovers that were so successful on Mars?
Well, one of the things about it is it has inside this rover, it has a real big laboratory to investigate. They have the capability of zapping rocks, for example, with a really powerful laser that will vaporize the tops of rocks. They'll be able to take samples of rocks, grind them up into a powder, and put them into an interior laboratory that will analyze all those rocks and things into a powder. And they'll look at it through spectrographs of different types and so on. But the whole instrument package is like 15 times the weight of anything else. The other unique thing about this rover is that it doesn't use solar panels as we have in the past, because they collect too much dust. Instead, it's run by a nuclear energy, actually a radioisotope thermoelectric generator, or RTG, utilizing plutonium-238. And that's got a half-life that'll help it through the 2 years of Earth years that it hopefully will be sending back data from Mars.
Okay, and Dave, thanks for the question. A couple more follow-ups to his question. So thanks for the call, Dave. We'll be back after a short break.
This is NHPR 919. Good morning. And more with our Sky Guys on all things astronomical on The Exchange on NHPR. And at 10 on The Diane Rehm Show, The Business Congress Left Behind. Well, there are many ways to support NHPR. If you have a couple of hours a week to donate, consider volunteering your time. NHPR volunteers are an integral part to all aspects of the smooth running of the station. Click on the About NHPR tab at nhpr.org to find out how you can help. Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and support also comes to us from Plymouth State University, offering selected bachelor's degrees online in business communication studies, criminal justice, and nursing. Details at plymouth.edu/online. And Hypertherm, an associate-owned manufacturer of metal cutting equipment made in New Hampshire and sold worldwide. Hypertherm.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we've been talking with our Sky Guys about the landing of the Mars rover Curiosity and its search now for the ingredients of possible life on the red planet. Join us with your questions or comments, 1-800-892-6477. Did you stay up until the wee hours of this morning to watch Curiosity land shortly after 1 a.m. Eastern Time? There are other NASA missions ongoing, too. If you're following them, we'd love your questions and comments at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. And John Gianforte, just before the break, Dave from Concord called and asked a great question. What's the idea behind this rover, given that NASA's had very successful rovers already on Mars for a number of years?
It really is, like you said, a great question. You can think of the Mars exploration rovers, Spirit and Opportunity, that landed in January of 2004, as mobile geologists. They did a lot of analysis of rocks. They were really trying to find out what role, if any, water played in Mars's history. That was in the past. They successfully detected a long presence of water in both sites that were separated by a pretty great distance on Mars. And that question answered Curiosity, or the Mars Science Laboratory, later named Curiosity, that instrument package was designed to look for the elements essential for life and to determine if Mars ever provided a habitat, either in the past or the present, for life. It's not looking for little creepy crawly little bugs.
It probably, or little green men.
It probably wouldn't recognize them if there were some crawling under its feet, unless we saw it with one of the 10 camera systems that the Curiosity has. But it is very sensitive to the elements that life needed to get started and to maintain life.
Here's my question, and we often hear that people are looking for, quote, signs of life, and they talk about the search, especially for the presence of water. Couldn't there, though, John, be life without water, just not life as we know it on Earth? I mean, are we thinking too narrowly here?
Yeah, it's a question I get in class all the time. It's a great question also, but we're working at somewhat of a disadvantage. All the astrobiologists and we only have one example of a planet that has life on it. And all of Earth's life is very, very related to each other. All life is based on DNA and carbon-based compounds, more than 99% of it. So it could very well be that life elsewhere is based on a different kind of chemistry, although water is a very, very common compound in the universe and the solar system. So
not just here on Earth.
Yes.
We found it on asteroids and other places.
It's all over the solar system and it's all over the universe. So it makes sense because the most common element in the universe is hydrogen and oxygen is number four. So it makes sense that there's a lot of water around. So And carbon is the third most abundant element in the universe. So it makes sense that life chemistry is going to take place with the materials that are available, provided the environment allows the chemistry to happen.
Within our solar system anyway. Who knows what's going on in other solar systems in terms of life?
Exactly.
You know, a couple more questions for you on Curiosity, and then I want to move on to other missions, because there is a lot more going on, despite all the excitement about this latest one. Justified excitement, I should say. Mal, to you, the grandest hopes for Curiosity. I mean, in the best possible scenario, what do we hope to get from this mission?
Well, first of all, Curiosity is a continuation of a plan to eventually send people to Mars. And their goal right now is after like the 2030s or so. So another 20, a couple of dozen years or so. We had the Mars exploration rovers, Spirit and Opportunity, who found now that there was evidence of water, when there was a history of water on Mars early on. And now what this is doing is taking the next step, looking at the potential for life. But at some point, we as humans want to go there. And so the more we find out about the environment that we would be exposed to at the time, the better that's going to make our planning to get to Mars at some point. And we're not going to be happy with constantly sending robots. We want to go there. We want to pick it up and hold it in our hand. We want to touch it, analyze it. And that's going to happen, probably not in my lifetime at this point, but at some point, somebody listening to this program right now may be stepping on Mars within the next 30 years.
Okay, and I always ask you gentlemen this question, but it's worth repeating, and John, I'll turn to you. You know, Mal says, we want to go there, and understandable. But given all the other challenges that we face here on Earth, including our own protecting our own planet, just because we want to go there, does that justify the budget for going there?
Well, it's another. You keep throwing these great questions out, Laura, and really in these tough economic times, it certainly warrants asking questions like that. But we'll start with learning more about our own planet by studying other examples of planets like Venus, like Mars, that our solar system contains two families of planets, the gas giants, which are out beyond Mars, and the terrestrials, which are inside of the asteroid belt, Mars, Earth, Venus, and Mercury. They are relatively similar in composition and makeup. By studying Mars, which is the best Earth analog we have, it teaches us more about what can happen on a planet. We know that Mars's axis of rotation has gyrated so that the seasons on Mars have widely varied over long periods of time. That certainly has affected Mars's climate. The poles of Mars have not always been located where the poles of Mars are today. And we know that's due to this huge variation in the tilt of its axis of rotation, whereas the Earth's axis of rotation has been at about 23.5 for many, many millions and hundreds of millions of years due to the gravitational influence, stabilizing influence of the moon. So that has made Earth's climate very consistent for long periods of time, and that has allowed, has been good for life. Life has a problem when it changes, the environment changes quicker than life can adapt. And when that happens, species become extinct, and there's a certain critical mass of species in order to maintain the chemistry of life and all of that. And if the environment changes too dramatically for life to evolve, you end up with a dead planet. So you learn a lot about your own planet by studying other planets.
One last question on this, and it's for you, Mal. What is going to be happening over the next days, weeks, months at the Discovery Center surrounding this Curiosity mission?
Well, today especially, we're going to be having special presentations on pretty much an hourly basis to fill in the gaps of what you may want to learn about Curiosity. So I would recommend highly, yes, by all means, come on by. And there's all kinds of other programs. And if I can put in a big plug, just check out starhop.com, our website. That'll fill in all the gaps of the special things we'll be doing. But today especially is our Curiosity hurrah day, I guess we could call it.
All right. Well, let's go back to our listeners, gentlemen. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Or you can post a comment on our Facebook page. And let's go next to Tom in Rochester. Hi, Tom. Thanks for waiting. You're on The Exchange.
Good morning, Laura. How are you?
Good.
Good. A question in reference to the program that I guess launched back in 2004, going out to the outer reaches of the solar system beyond Pluto. I don't recall the name. I apologize. I have it at the house. But how is that moving along? And is it still planned to be out there for 2013 or is it 2015? And what is the, what are the goals of that that program?
Right. Tom, thanks a lot for the question. John, go ahead.
We're fighting over answering this question, Tom.
Because they're both so excited.
It's a great mission. It's called New Horizons, and it is due to arrive in the Pluto system on the 14th of July, 2015. So it reached its back in December of 2011, New Horizons became the closest, reached a point in space where it was the closest spacecraft to Pluto that any spacecraft ever got to Pluto. That was previously held by the Voyager 2 spacecraft, and it was never a target for Voyager 2. That was about a billion miles away, which is pretty far. Mm-hmm. But now New Horizons has broken that record, and it's making it its way toward Pluto every day. So it's breaking a new record, its own record every day. So, and I said the Pluto system because Pluto isn't just a single a dwarf planet. It is a dwarf planet with three moons, if not four, and one of the moons of Pluto is nearly half the size of Pluto. So it is a really interesting place, and scientists believe that there are materials in that system left over from the origin of the solar system some 4.65 billion years ago.
So because it's so far out, it may tell us what happened to create our own solar system.
Yes, it's very cold, so chemistry happens very, very slowly when it's cold. And with such a cold temperature, there haven't been much reactions or chemical reactions that far out. And that will leave you with pretty much pristine material to study.
Mal, you want to jump in there?
Yeah. Tom, I just want to mention the New Horizons spacecraft was launched in January of 2006. So it takes like 9.5 years total to get to Pluto. And it's not a spacecraft that's going to go into orbit around Pluto. It's so far away. Consider it takes 14 minutes for a radio signal to get to us one way from Mars. Consider how much further away the distance of Pluto is, and you get a pretty good idea of how impossible it would be to steer everything. The spacecraft itself is about the size of a grand piano. If you think of a grand piano sending it into space, if you have a noisy neighbor who has one, you may want to do that someday. I don't know. But in any event, it's going to fly past it. So its closest approach will be in July of 2015. But it's going to keep going into the area of space that's known as the Kuiper Belt. And there are many other objects that qualify, even a few that qualify as dwarf planets there as well. So it's not going to look just at Pluto. Eventually, it should be able to investigate a few other, depending on how long its power goes, but it should be able to investigate. It's also the fastest spacecraft ever launched.
You'd have to be fast to go all the way to Pluto.
Yeah, well, even to get there in 9.5 years, when it was launched, it went past the moon in less than a day.
Wow.
And it took us 3 days to get there in the Apollo program. So,
Tom, thanks a lot for that call. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Today in the exchange, our Sky Guys are here. We're looking at the exciting development just this morning with the landing of the new Mars Laboratory Curiosity. Other missions, too, that we're talking about, including New Horizons heading out towards Pluto. And, gentlemen, I want to ask you also about Dawn. The last time we talked, it was orbiting the asteroid Vesta in that cool asteroid belt that isn't too far from here, John. What have we learned so far from this exploration of Vesta? And we should say Dawn isn't landing there and probing, but it's telling us a lot anyway from its orbit.
No, it's not landing. It's got a really interesting history, and I'll try to give it to you in 10 seconds. It got to Vesta last year, and it spent a year orbiting this large asteroid. The asteroid belt is pretty wide, and it contains several hundred thousand asteroids. Now, the asteroid belt in reality is a lot different from the Hollywood visions of the asteroid belt. We've never had a problem having spacecraft pass through the asteroid belt en route to the outer solar system because the spacing between asteroids is so great. If you were standing on one, you couldn't see the nearest asteroid to you.
Well, I'm glad you said that because the pictures you get in the books and on the puzzles and posters and stuff make it look like, you know, watch out, you're going to bang into another asteroid.
Well, so if they depicted that in Hollywood movies, it'd be kind of a boring place. But the inner asteroid belt where Vesta is located, and the asteroid belt is a range between the orbits of Mars and Jupiter. Vesta is an inner asteroid belt asteroid. Inner asteroids are believed to be much drier. They are more rocky, very little water, that's true of Vesta, and we also learned that Vesta is large enough and massive enough to have once differentiated itself. That means it was a molten object where the heavy material, the heavy stuff, sunk to the bottom, and then the lighter stuff sunk and landed on top of that, and it's a layered asteroid. We didn't know that, and that's very similar to how the Earth and the other terrestrial planets were formed. When on the 8th of September, when Dawn blasts out of orbit around Vesta, it is headed to the largest and first asteroid to be discovered, called Ceres. And it was discovered in January of 1801, and it's a little over 550 miles across, and it is on the outer edge of the asteroid belt, believed to be much wetter.
So this is a very different asteroid. Ceres is very different from Vesta.
That's right. Now, we haven't been to Ceres yet, but that's why these two different asteroids, in fact, Ceres is a dwarf planet. That's why it's headed to these two different asteroids and on opposite ends of the asteroid belt, because we believe their characters will be much different. And it'll give us some insight as to how the solar system formed and give us the nature of the asteroid belt itself.
Again, our number is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. The number 1-800-892-6477. One more mission I did want to ask both of you about, and that's Juno. And Mal, we've talked about this before, but this is a big deal. It's going to arrive at Jupiter in a couple years, right? It's heading out towards Jupiter. More like 4 years, yeah. Heading towards the gas giant Jupiter. Obviously, it can't land there.
Right.
So what's it going to do, Mal?
Well, it's a very unusual mission because it's going to be studying looking beneath the clouds of Jupiter. One of its missions is to find out whether it has a solid core way down inside it. And it's going to try to learn about the origins of the atmosphere. It has a huge magnetosphere around it, which is another thing they want to study, but it also can be a dangerous thing. The unique real thing about this is that normally you send something out through the asteroid belt to the outer planets, it has to be nuclear powered, just like the Mars Curiosity is. And in this case, they're actually using solar panels, because the unique part about it is that it can end up facing, the way they're going to be orbiting Jupiter is from the side and not, say, think of it that way. And it's going to be orbiting with the solar panel spinning like three big solar panels. The whole diameter is about 66 feet in diameter. And it's going to be rotating like a big windmill. And it will sneak in across the poles into the lower regions under this magnetosphere, so it won't get zapped as often. It will take 11 weeks to do one orbit.
Wow, it's a long time.
And so it's going to be a very elliptical, elongated orbit. So it kind of sneaks in, goes around the planet, sneaks out the bottom of the planet. But it'll give it a chance to have all of its instruments as it spins to do separate readings on what's going on in there.
Well, what's incredible to me is that it's powered by solar power, as you said, Mal.
Exactly.
And Jupiter is not close to the sun.
No, it isn't. It gets very little power from the sun, so these have to be very huge solar panels. But they can arrange it so that as it spins, those solar panels are constantly facing the sun. It never goes behind Jupiter. And that's what makes this possible.
All right. Well, coming up after a break, definitely want to ask both of you about solar activity and what's been going there. We'll get the latest exoplanet count from John as well, and a lot more of your questions and comments at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org, and we'll be right back.
Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Gibson's Bookstore in Concord, welcoming author Jenny Fields on August 8th at 7 p.m. discussing her newest book, The Age of Desire. Details at gibsonsbookstore.com. And from New Hampshire Hospital for Children, located at Elliott Hospital in Manchester, bringing pediatric emergency medicine, pediatric surgery, and pediatric critical care to your children. Good morning, it's 9:40. This is NHPR.
NHPR's summer car raffle may be on its way out, but there's plenty of time left in the season to enjoy the prizes. The Trek bike from S&W Sports comes with a roof-mounted rack for your car so you can take it on vacation with you. And the kayak from Portsmouth Kayak Adventures is a great way to explore New Hampshire's many waterways. But get your tickets today at nhpr.org or call 1-888-805-NHPR. And good luck.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, is the skills gap a myth? Our guest, who's a prominent business professor and author, says yes. Email us your thoughts before the program at exchange@nhpr.org and join us tomorrow morning, live at 9. Today in The Exchange, our sky guys are here and we're looking at all things astronomical. We've been catching up on several missions, one to Pluto, one to Jupiter, one to the asteroid belt, and of course the big one, the landing of the Mars rover Curiosity last night. Our number for you to join us with your questions and comments on these is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org or post a comment on our Facebook page. And John Gianforte, I wanted to go to you about solar activity. Science writers will say the sun has been quiet or the sun has been active. Just first of all, what does that mean exactly and why is that important?
It's very important because the sun plays a very active role in space weather. And that may sound funny, but that's a real term, and it describes the space environment in the inner solar system. And that's where the Earth is. The sun, its activity ebbs and flows on an 11-year cycle. And right now, we are approaching a peak to that cycle, probably in late 2013 or early 2014. The last cycle, the minimum of the last cycle, was extended. It lasted longer than a sun scientist believed, and it was a much deeper minimum. There were many, many days in 2008, 2009, where there were no sunspots. Sunspots are a place on the sun's surface that is represented by a dark spot. And that's dark because it's about 1,000 to 1,300 degrees Celsius cooler than the surrounding surface of the sun. So the spot appears dark. If you took a shovelful of sunspot material and threw it off into space, it would be bright. But compared to the rest of the solar photosphere, the surface of the sun, it looks dark.
And that affects the weather here on Earth, right? It affects electromagnetic activity. It can even affect power systems, depending on what the sun's doing.
Yeah, it certainly, solar activity can affect not the daily weather on the Earth, but the climate of the Earth and the long-term weather forecast for the planet. And certainly sunspots arise on the sun's surface due to the interplay of the sun's very, very powerful magnetic field. And this can unleash coronal mass ejections, where millions of tons of superheated plasma are erupted from the sun's surface. And if those coronal mass ejections are Earth-directed, in a day or two, depending on the speed of the ejection, those particles can strike the Earth's magnetic field.
Which amazes me, because 93 million miles, you'd think most of that energy would be dissipated by the time it gets to us.
No, they still maintain their charge and their speed, and the most visible effect of this is the beautiful northern and southern lights that many people across the country and all over the world have been treated to earlier in the year.
We have another question for you both on this, and Mal, I have to ask this. That giant blackout in India, for example, last week or so, was that possibly related to solar activity?
I really doubt it. I don't think that there's any relation. We did, I know what you're saying. Years ago in 1989, there was a coronal mass ejection of the sun that was so powerful it wiped out the northeast quarter of North America.
Yeah, Quebec.
Parts of Canada, Quebec, and New England and New York State, all that were wiped out because, I mean, yes, they can be very powerful. This plasma is electromagnetically charged plasma, and that can really do some damage if we're not aware of it. I think the problem in India, the way I understand it, was just people were overusing and they just couldn't keep up with it.
Well, and here's another question, again, based on the increased solar activity that you talked about. Is it possible, John, that the scorcher that they've been having in the South and Midwest this year is due to some cycle of the sun?
I would say no.
Yeah.
That's too quick for that to have had an effect, because the Earth has a thick atmosphere and it has a lot of water on its surface, and that has a tendency to smooth out any large differences in solar energy output, which aren't very much. They don't amount to a fraction of 1% of the sun's output. So you're not going to find daily weather affected by daily occurrences on the sun, but long term, possibly.
All right. Well, let's take some more questions and comments from our listeners. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And gentlemen, a couple emails have come in about Curiosity. Here's one from Glenn. He says, with all the neat things that Curiosity and possible successors can do, is there any advantage to sending manned expeditions to Mars? And Glenn says, yes, my wife and I did stay up to watch the landing. Great drama. Good for you, Glenn.
All right.
You know, we talked about this before. When I asked that basic question, why bother? Mal, what do you think? What is Curiosity not able to do that people could do?
Well, it's kind of a hard question to answer from my point of view. Maybe John has a better idea on this. But I'm just thinking, yes, they can do the chemical analyses, things like that. But they're very tedious. They're very slow. It takes
time.
The rovers are. It takes time. Someone is sitting on the ground saying, oh, there looks like an interesting rock. Let's tell the rover to go over and investigate that particular rock. And then maybe a day or two later, you might have some sort of analysis from it. The advantage with a human being on Mars is that humans can eyeball something and they can do several analyses in one day. And they will have a much better eye to instantly decide, I can pick this up, I can pick that up. I don't have to go through a triage or of some sort to decide, is this really worth going to? The downside, of course, is that going to Mars as humans is we have to learn how to survive on Mars.
A 9-month mission to say nothing of once you get there.
Yeah, you don't have to feed a rover.
Right.
All the things that humans need to do. They need air to breathe. The rover doesn't need that. It's got all the energy it needs built in. But after a while, it's going to die out too. But still, there is an advantage with humans in being able to do things more quickly. But we want to make sure they can also get there safely and come home and tell us about what they did.
Here's another email again about Curiosity. This is from Ben. He says, will Curiosity be able to gather data on Mars's long-term development so that we can learn more about the lifespan of the planet? Or are they primarily studying the current chemical composition of the planet? Thanks, Ben, for that question. John, do you know?
Yes. It will absolutely study the history of the planet. One of the reasons that Gale Crater was selected is because near the center of the crater, and not very far from where Curiosity landed, there's a 3-mile-high mountain in the middle of the crater. It's called Mount Sharp, at least unofficially. And that mountain, that central peak, or that peak that I'm talking about, has been seen from orbiting spacecraft that have 20/20 vision and can resolve very, very small details on the surface, has found layered sedimentary rock in that mountain. So what the thought is to send, not only will Curiosity study the present climate and habitat potential for life, but by studying the geologic record preserved in these sedimentary rocks, it can study Mars's past. If you've ever gone to the southwestern part of the United States, particularly the Grand Canyon, I've been there a couple of times, and if you float down the Colorado River, you can go through a history of planet Earth's geology to pretty close to 2 billion years ago. And the scientists are going to use those sedimentary rocks that are on display as a part of Mount Sharp to do exactly that. That's a great question.
All right, Ben, thanks for the email. Again, the address, exchange@nhpr.org. The number, 1-800-892-6477. Or you can post a comment on our Facebook page. And, John, I did want to get the latest from you. It's amazing to me. Every time you come here to talk with us, there are more exoplanets that have been discovered. Remind us just real quickly what an exoplanet is, and then you can give us the latest count.
Sure. An exoplanet or extrasolar planet is simply a planet that astronomers have discovered that orbits a star other than the sun. So the sun has 8 major planets and a whole bunch of dwarf planets, lots of asteroids, and lots of comets. We now know and have known since 1989, when the first extrasolar planet was discovered, that there are many other planetary systems out there in space. So there is a huge rush, and has been since 1995, when the first sun-like star was found to have a planet orbiting it, that we are up to 777 confirmed extrasolar planets. Now, there are more than 2,300 extrasolar planet candidates, and we have a great spacecraft, NASA spacecraft called Kepler, that was launched in March of 2009.
Replaced the Hubble, right?
Nope. It has a completely different mission.
Ah.
It's an interesting mission in that this spacecraft stares at the same place in space all the time. It's a very small, it's a 10 degree by 10 degree patch of sky. It's kind of like holding your fist at arm's distance. That's the dimension of the square that Kepler looks at. And it looks at 156,000 stars simultaneously and constantly takes images of that field of stars. And what it does, it looks for stars that regularly dim and then brighten again in cyclical patterns. And that is the signature of a planet, an extrasolar planet, transiting or eclipsing the disk of its parent star. And when it does that, the light from the star that we can see in our telescopes gets dimmer by a very, very, very small amount. Too small for the human eye to detect, but not too small for electronic imaging systems to detect.
So we look at the star and we see how it reacts to this planet orbiting it, and when the light is dimmed, we can say, oh, there's a planet orbiting this star.
Well, Kepler goes a couple of steps further. It looks for two transits of the same star separated by an equal period and looks for the third transit. When it detects three at a third transit at the right time, it says, okay, I've got a candidate, and that's sent to the ground for ground-based observatories to follow up on.
All right, and 777. Who knows what it will be the next time we talk, John. You know, a little closer to home, Mal, August is a great month to get out, not just because it's beautiful outside, but there's a show on, right, this month?
Well, not counting the one we had last night.
The meteor showers.
But there is a show coming up this weekend, this coming weekend, overnight, the 11th and 12th, so Sunday to Monday, I guess that is the annual Perseids meteor shower. It's called the Perseids because if you follow the meteor trails backwards through the sky, they tend to radiate from the constellation of Perseus. And that's how all these get named. But you don't have to worry about even finding Perseus. If the weather allows us to and there are no clouds or storms or anything, my suggestion is get up in the early morning hours. Similar to what we did this morning on Monday morning. Is going to be the best time, or is it Saturday to Sunday, John?
Yeah.
It's Saturday to Sunday. Oh, even better. So
both
Sunday
nights.
Morning. But both nights. Right.
And go out at night.
Two or three in the morning is good. And just find a nice place where you can just kind of lie down. Don't stand there and stick your head up in the air because you'll have a real stiff neck at the end of that. But if you can find a place where you can lie down on a blanket or whatever, it's a great time of year to do that. And just glance around the sky, just eyeball the sky back and forth, and you should have a chance to see as many as 50 an hour. The moon will not be a problem because it'll be a small waning crescent moon by then. But next weekend, this coming weekend, upcoming is the time to do it. And it could be early Sunday morning or even Monday morning.
All right. We'll cross our fingers for clear weather. It's always
always
a bummer to have a meteor shower coming through. And
I always have a contest with my daughter every year, who now in New York City, so she has very little chance. But we used to go out on a regular basis every year and just see how many meteors we could count.
Oh, that's great. Well, and speaking of shows, then coming up in September, John, I know you're real busy putting this together, the Fall Astronomy Festival, advertised as hundreds of telescopes, billions of stars.
That's right. We're the University of New Hampshire, in cooperation with the New Hampshire Astronomical Society, is putting on the second New England Fall Astronomy Festival to be held on campus at the UNH campus in Durham, right around the observatory. And the organizing committee has been working very hard to put promotional information out. This is a family-friendly event. It's designed to attract students and their families. It's a Friday night and an all-day Saturday and Saturday night event. There'll be solar observing during the day, observing of the stars and planets at night, talks during the day, lots of kids' activities, food, lots of really neat family-oriented activities, and some great raffle prizes that we're raffling off. So it's a great family weekend of astronomy fun, and we don't charge any admission. We thought that was really important.
One more thing that's happening this month, and I love this, Mal, a blue moon. Now, it's not going to be really blue, but this is an old-fashioned phrase for a special kind of moon.
It means a very rare happening of, in this case, today, the definition has kind of changed a little bit. But originally, what a blue moon was, any fourth full moon in a season. And that got changed, right, John?
Yes, it did. Yes, it did. And now that has evolved to any month containing a second blue moon, a second full moon, excuse me, that second full moon is the blue moon.
And why do they call it blue, though? It doesn't look blue.
It doesn't look blue, and it doesn't look blue. It doesn't look any different from any other full moon. And
basically means rare. Moon,
yes,
rare.
Exactly.
That's the whole
All
idea.
Right, giving the saying once in a blue moon.
Once exactly. Exactly.
Well, gentlemen, I hope it's more less than once in a blue moon when we see you again. I want to thank you both very much for coming in.
If I may add something, if you have never seen a sunspot up close through a telescope, come on by the Discovery Center when it's nice and bright. We've been looking at a lot of them through our observatory down there. So hopefully, come on by and see us.
All right. Well, both of you, thank you very much for coming by and seeing us today. Mal, thanks a lot for being here. Really
appreciate
it. You
are welcome. Always a joy.
Mal Cameron, longtime educator at the McAuliffe-Shepherd Discovery Center. John Gianforte, good to see you, too. Thank you for being here.
It was wonderful, Laura. Thank you.
John Gianforte, co-founder of the Astronomical Society of Northern New England. His website is theskyguy.org. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our intern is Tim Camerato. The Exchange's executive producer is Keith Shields. And I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Kanoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, is the skills gap a myth? It's a common complaint that despite high unemployment, companies can't find the right people, creating a gap between the skills they need and what workers have. But our guest says it's simply not the case. The problem, he says, is employers themselves, too often holding unrealistic expectations and unwilling to train perfectly acceptable candidates. Email us at nhpr.org and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
The Diane Rehm Show, next at 10 o'clock on NHPR, where we get support from UR members. And support also comes to us from Prescott Park Arts Festival and Seacoast Repertory Theater, presenting the Common Man Restaurant Family Summer Musical, Willy Wonka, in Portsmouth, prescottpark.org. And from Dartmouth Hitchcock, providing online health